Morning. Thanks, everybody. Sorry I'm late. We got Brian Hagel to talk about student loan discharges. We are looking for speakers and topics going forward. If we don't get some, we will not be continuing the tradition. So I hope that some people will step up. Some of the questions that are being asked of the Mike or Listserv would make great topics. If you know the answers or know somebody who does, suggest them, ask them to come and speak. It's really appreciated, and I think it's a great event. I want to keep it going, but we need folks to step up and offer to do topics. Today, again, thank you, Brian, and take it away.
The judge isn't legally allowed to say this, but if you give a presentation, you get two free wins in front of her. I know. Don't mention that live, right? Thanks. I'm Brian Pagel. I'm with Kirkman & Dunn. I'm here to talk about administrative discharges. Most of you have not been to a seminar with me before. I have the wonderful paralegals from my office, Jennifer and Taylor, with me. I like to get lots of audience participation. I can tell by the fact that you're all crammed as far back from me as possible that you don't want to participate. So to help bribe you with that, I bring treats. We have breakfast bars, chewy granola bars, and Captain Crunch bars for the health nuts among us. So if I call on you, if you volunteer some information, if you ask a question, if you are a federal judge, you're entitled to some sort of snack, so feel free to...
You're taking my spot there, Brian.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That gives me a treat right there.
Thanks for not mentioning that. I appreciate that. All right, so how many people here have taken out a student loan in their lifetime? How many people here would like to not repay that student loan? How many people here have ever taken a step to not repay that student loan besides sometimes skipping a payment when you've got more important things to do? You can tell they work with me. I've got the statistics on student loans in there. Did everyone read the information before they came down here today, or are you coming in here cold? Raise your hand if you didn't read the information. Lots of brave volunteers. That's excellent. We'll be calling on all of you. They marked you. The student loans, as we all know, are in the news a lot. They are constantly talked about, constantly debated. There's lots and lots of discussion about what to do about student loans, except among lawyers. And what I hear from lawyers and what I hear from clients when they talk about student loans is, oh, well, there's nothing you can do about them. I've worked with bankruptcy lawyers. Everyone in this room a bankruptcy lawyer? Raise your hand if you're not. Yes? You're not a bankruptcy lawyer? Let's pick on you for a second. What do you do?
Family law.
Okay, so you run into student loans, right? Have to divide them up in divorce?
No.
No? They don't discuss them at all, or do they ask you about them?
It's usually the person who incurred it is the one who usually takes their own student loans.
Okay, so is there ever a fight over who's going to end up paying that student loan? I've done a little bit of family law, and I've had some people bickering about how much they're going to pay about it. If you do low income, you probably don't run into as much of the doctor paying off the student loan.
No.
Okay. So I've done some family law. I do consumer protection law, which is sort of anyone who gets in trouble with an organization of one sort or another comes to me and asks me if I can do something about it. And about 8 years ago, I began doing a lot of foreclosure defense, mostly because the bankruptcy and civil lawyers around the state didn't really know what to do about foreclosure defense. And I had people coming into me and saying, I've been to a couple bankruptcy lawyers, and they say they can put me into a Chapter 13 or Chapter 7, get rid of it, or reform that, but it's too expensive for me, and I can't do it. We began investigating ways to figure out what to do about foreclosures. And student loans now are right at the spot where foreclosures were back in 2005 and 2006. Everyone remembers how great things were back then, right? We've been struggling through the economic crisis since then, largely because of the debt load that caused the banks to crash because the foreclosure crisis came about. Now with student loan debts rising and rising and rising, calls to my office and probably to your offices are increasing where people ask about their student loans. And again, the common refrain I'm hearing from people is they're calling up and they're saying, I talked to a bankruptcy lawyer, and bankruptcy lawyers tell me, anyone? I'm just going to pick someone out at random. Let's pick out you, sir. What's your name? In the front. Oh, okay, we'll go with you. All right, Tim. Tim.
Nothing
you can do. What's the one way you can try to get out of student loan in a bankruptcy? Even I know this, and I don't do any bankruptcy whatsoever.
Die.
Hardship.
Die will get you out of it, but you don't have to file bankruptcy to die, do you?
No.
We should check with the judge. I don't think that's a requirement yet. I know Congress tightened it up.
credit counseling if you die.
So they have, in fact, tightened it up a bit. So if someone said undue hardship, how high does the level of undue hardship have to rise? Anyone? This high?
Super
this high?
High?
Above the ceiling?
Super high.
Super high. If you're quadriplegic, can you qualify for an undue hardship discharge in bankruptcy court?
Maybe not.
Maybe.
So someone comes in and says, I've got $100,000 in student loan debt, and I'm quadriplegic and haven't been able to find a job in 5 years. And all of you bankruptcy lawyers who think 100% for sure you can get them out of that student loan, raise your hands. That's why they end up... Taylor's got a plan.
Was there a case?
Was there a case?
Yeah.
Have you read that case?
I
don't know. I don't read bankruptcy law. I'm just making this stuff up here. None of these guys practice my area of law. They can't tell if I'm right. That's how seminars work. Let's give Taylor a candy bar. All right, so you can't guarantee this person to get out of their loan for undue hardship, even though they might not be employed, and even though they're probably in some sort of motorized wheelchair, and even though we know that limits their prospect for economic advancement. They're just thinking, or was there a question, Justin?
No, it's nothing.
Okay. Don't move, or I'll light on you. I don't want to talk very much up here. All right. So what can you do to get the person out of that student loan? Does anyone here prior to today, had you heard about the administrative discharge for other than undue hardship? Raise your hand if you had. You had heard about it?
Yes.
How did you hear about it, ma'am? National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys listserv. I'm going to repeat that in case they didn't pick it up on the phone. So what did you hear about it on the listserv for the administrative discharge?
There's been a lot of talk about how to get one.
Okay. Does anyone know for sure how to get one?
Yes, some of the people on the listserv do.
Okay. And these are consumer bankruptcy attorneys. They're just starting to talk about this, though, right?
Yes, it's become really big in the last 6 months.
And why do you suppose it's become really big in the last 6 months?
Because bankruptcies are down. And so they're looking for another way to increase their income.
There you go. And that's why I want to get involved in student loans, too. And that's kind of the key point for all of you, is we're looking for ways to increase our income, by which I mean, Judge, we're looking for ways to ethically help our clients out of their jams, right? Nothing tricky going on here. So that's last part is for the Office of Lawyer Regulation as well. I'm required to say that with almost every bit of advice I give. So student loan debtors are coming into bankruptcy attorneys and asking about administrative discharges. And why are they coming into bankruptcy attorneys and asking about that? Anyone? Should we pick on Jennifer for a while? Why are they coming up to bankruptcy attorneys? Why are student loan debtors coming into bankruptcy attorneys and asking about administrative discharges?
Where else would you go?
Where else would you go? You guys are the front lines for debtors who want help. When they call every other lawyer in the world, when they call family law attorneys, when they call consumer protection attorneys, when they ask their friends and neighbors, when they look online, they're going to come to bankruptcy attorneys. And so you're going to want to know about administrative student loan discharges, which is why you have this handy packet. You're also going to want to know what we'll run through today, which is how you interview your client to even decide if they can qualify for an administrative discharge. Because you're going to spend a lot of time with these clients figuring out if they can qualify for an administrative discharge if you don't know what you're looking for. And so I wanted to run through the things you need to know about your client, the things you need to know about their school, and the things you need to know about their loan when you sit down and interview them. Not everyone is lucky enough to have Taylor and Jennifer interview all their clients for them so they never have to be bothered and can nap in their office all day. I have that. You may want to do your client intakes yourself. So let's first talk about what you want to know about the client. When the client calls and says, I have a student loan problem and I need some help, put aside your bankruptcy hats for a second. What are you going to want to know about that client before you can decide if they can get an administrative discharge? Those of you who have read the packet before, feel free to jump in here. But if you haven't read the packet and you have an idea what kinds of things you want to ask your client, start with that. I see, let's go with Tim. I saw your hand up.
Yeah, where they went to school.
Where they went to school. That's very good. Why do you want to know where they went to school?
If it was a fly-by-night school or if it was a legitimate school.
Bingo. That should get you two breakfast bars if you haven't already gotten one. Fly-by-night schools, trade schools, tech schools, private schools, these things are directly what the administrative discharges are aimed at. So they're not so much going after people who went to an awesome law school like the University of Wisconsin or a reasonably creditable school like the University of Marquette. They're going after the people that...
You're in Milwaukee. That's a bad move.
I understand that. I realized that almost as soon as I said it.
Did you have a probationary period with the firm?
He's from Madison.
Yeah,
I mean, come
on.
I
know that, but so am I.
And you went to Marquette?
I did.
If y'all excuse me for a moment. Anyway, these fly-by-night schools are the ones that they're aimed at. All the private schools that you hear opening up, trucker schools, baker schools, tech schools, paralegal institutes, other than perhaps the ones that our paralegals went to, I don't even know,
no.
So I'm just not going to name them. But those kinds of short-term private-funded schools are primarily what the administrative discharge was aimed at, because Congress got very worried that once they made lots of federal money available and guaranteed that that federal loan would be paid back by the federal government if no one else could, that for some reason people were going to start taking advantage of that. Who could imagine, right? So they set up this system designed to go after primarily these fly-by-night rip-off schools. So first thing you're going to ask is, where'd you go to school? The second thing you're going to ask is what? Is there anyone? Yeah, let's see. What was your name again, ma'am?
Nancy,
go ahead.
Did you have a high school diploma?
Exactly. Why do you want to ask that? Did you do the reading in advance, or are you just taking
a test? We were sitting here looking through it, yes.
Okay, so why do you want to know if they had a high school diploma?
Because they may not actually have been eligible to benefit from that school.
That's right. If you read through the materials, one of the criteria that has to be asked about in order for you to qualify for a student loan, and this has to be certified by the school that you go to, is that you have the quote-unquote ability to benefit from that student loan and the education that's funded. And the base measure for ability to benefit from that student loan is, do you have a high school diploma or the equivalent? So that person didn't finish high school. If they say they never graduated high school, you're probably on to something. You want to ask if they have a GED or passed some other sort of standardized test that would certify that they at least progressed beyond high school. Now, I'll lead you into this one a little bit. If they graduated high school, what's the next thing you want to ask them? Hint, it begins with graduate. Yeah, I heard something over here. Not when did you graduate high school, but you're on the right track. When did you graduate? College. There you go. Taylor, I think, has the answer key up here. When did you graduate college? You want to ask them if they graduated, right? And why? Anyone want to take a stab at why it's important to know if they graduated? I'm going to pick on someone. What's that? You're already here. You get all the leftover cards anyway. Let's see. Let's go with someone a little further back. About a second from the red back there. Can I pick on you?
Sure.
All right. What's your name?
Matt.
Matt, why do you want to know if they graduated the college program?
Was there any value there?
You're on the right track, I think. The idea is that if they didn't finish the program, either they withdrew from the program, in which case they might be eligible for an administrative discharge equal to the amount they're refundable. If you withdraw from school, you don't qualify for the remainder of the student loans, and the school has to refund any unearned portion that they're still holding. You, of course, if you receive the funds, you're supposed to give it right back, and everyone, I'm sure, does that. As soon as they withdraw from school, they mail a check to the lender. But if you withdraw from school for any reason, there might be a refund owed to the lender that the school has to pay back. So you first ask them, did you graduate? And if not, why? Did you withdraw? And secondly, there's a closed school administrative discharge. And we know these schools close all the time. So if the school closed or if they withdrew, then you're going to go on to asking them, why did the school close, perhaps? You may have to investigate that. Or why did you withdraw? And if they withdrew because the program changed, or if they withdrew because the teachers were no longer available or the program was closed, they may again qualify for an administrative discharge. As a sideline, it's beyond the scope of this seminar, if the school changed the program midway through their process, there may be claims you can make against the lender for some sort of false advertising or deceptive trade practices claim. Those claims are very, very hard to do, but generally speaking, the lender may be liable for anything that the school committed as a tort to get the person in there to take the loan. So you're asking them why they withdrew from school, or why they didn't finish school, or why the school closed. What else might you want to know about your client before you move on to the more fun portions of this interview? There's one final thing you probably want to ask about. Yeah?
Did you actually take out a loan?
Actually, I was going to jump to that in the third section, but let's do that as a client part of the interview. Why do you want to know that?
Well, I mean, if you run a credit report, you see University of Phoenix on there. Did you go to the school there? Is this actually worth that?
The identity theft administrative discharge. Have you read that in the materials, or do you just know a lot about identity theft? You don't have to answer that latter question. All right, so the identity theft administrative discharge actually comes up quite a bit in what little litigation there is over this, because people are constantly either subject to claims of identity theft or appearing that they were the subject to a claim of identity theft. That's one of the big worries that people have nowadays. I get lots and lots of calls about identity theft. I've never actually met anyone who was the victim of identity theft. My own standard on identity theft is, if you want to steal my identity, I will hand it over to you. I owe so much in student loans and mortgage debt and other debts that you are free to take my identity. If you qualify for credit, we'll split it 60-40. So,
but you get a lot of calls about identity theft, and one of the leading cases out there is, in fact, an identity theft case where they help establish what you would need to know and what you might need to prove to the Secretary of Education to get this administrative discharge, or to the court if you're denied by the secretary. That's ultimately the way these things get reviewed. You apply to the servicer of your loan, who acts on behalf of the secretary. They make a decision. If you don't like the decision, you get an administrative review by the courts. That's all explained in the materials. Identity theft is actually surprisingly hard to prove. There's a lot of technical details that you have to go into. So when you're asking your client who claims they're the victim of identity theft whether they actually took out the loan, you have to also delve into, did you attend classes during the time that the loan was taken out? So you get clever students out there who will attend classes, take out a loan, have someone else sign the application, and they don't then have a signature that matches. So they'll go later and claim identity theft to try and get out of the loan. But you have to demonstrate either that you didn't attend classes during the period of time the loan funded, or you have to demonstrate that you paid for that class through some other alternative means. But the presumption is the loan paid for the class. And that's a common sense kind of presumption, because we know college is expensive. We know if you were enrolled in college, you must have paid for it some way. So they've thought ahead to the people who are going to forge their own identity theft and get out of their student loans later on. The case, the primary case, is mentioned in your materials under the identity theft sources, but there, a man claimed that his ex-wife had forged his signatures and taken out a bunch of student loans in his name. This is probably something you might come across in family law every now and then. Nodding. Yep. So you get those claims that ex-wives, it's almost always ex-wives who are alleged to have forged something. I've never had a wife come into my office and claim that her husband forged something. I don't know why it's the guys that latch on to this argument, but it seems to be the case. Would you agree, percentage-wise?
I actually have a case right now where the wife is saying that the husband forged something.
Shot down my first time out the gate. Sorry. We have an ex-wife claiming? You probably shouldn't talk about that at an open mic, right? Anyway, he claims that his ex-wife is forging his signature and taking out these student loans. He provides all kinds of samples of his signature. You're supposed to provide, I think it's in the materials, I think it's 5 separate pre-existing exemplars of your signature, like a signed Social Security card or driver's license, to the secretary. He then gets a decision back from the Secretary of Education that he doesn't like. They're saying, no, we don't think you're the victim of identity theft. Pay these loans back. And he appeals it to the court through the administrative review process. Now, the standard of review by the courts here is, of course, just whether the secretary acted within his discretion or the decision was arbitrary in some way. It's an administrative review. Anyone ever gone through an administrative review? There we go. We have a hand up there. So can you walk us through the process just briefly?
Well, you have to go through every level of appeal in the agency first before you get into the court system, and then you end up suing the agency, basically, to get it into the court system.
Exactly. So there's an exhaustion doctrine. Exhaustion of remedies is what you're describing there. When you file with your servicer and the servicer denies you, you can file an appeal through the secretary. Once you've walked all the way up and you have a final determination that's adverse to you, you file an action against the final decision maker, which is the Secretary of Education. If you read these cases, most of them are someone versus Department of Education, or lately someone versus Duncan, because Arne Duncan is the Secretary of Education. The court then just...
filing that in the federal district court, or...?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it gets filed as an original action in the federal district court under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Okay.
So, and it's a certiorari review, in essence, which just means that the court is going to look at the records. They're not going to take new evidence. They're not going to take new affidavits. They're going to look and say, what evidence did you present to the secretary, and was the secretary's determination arbitrary or capricious? So the judicial review is really kind of a last resort sort of thing. Now, we'll finish up with a case where a guy's going to probably win on judicial review almost by default, but if you've gone that far, there's very little that the judges are going to do typically to upset the secretary's determination. In the identity theft case, the leading identity theft case, the reason the judge didn't upset the determination had to do with the fact that the exemplars of signatures provided by the claimant, in fact, matched the signature on the loan. So the judge noted that in a footnote and found that that helped support the fact that the decision was not arbitrary. I don't know what that guy was thinking, but that's now become the leading case on identity theft. It more or less stands for how not to prove you were the victim of identity theft. I would assume if you're going to try and put one over on the Secretary of Education in the courts, you're going to at least try to find examples of your signatures that aren't near photographic duplicates of the signature on the student loan application. But that was his particular strategy. So you're going to ask if you're a victim of identity theft. You could ask if the person was divorced or separated or has perhaps brothers or sisters that might engage in that kind of activity. It's very, very easy for a relative to get the information that would allow them to take out these student loans. So you want to, if the person is claiming identity theft, really delve into why they think it's identity theft and who they figure could have stolen their identity with such success. It's very difficult, if you think about it, to get much information on the rest of us unless you actually know that person or have access to their personal information. Anything else you want to ask your client about? Anything else you want to know? Anything about their background, perhaps? Their criminal background, perhaps? I can't drag you any further than this. I'm just going to say, you want to ask about their criminal background. That's about the extent that I'm allowed to lead, I think, right? So you ask about their criminal background, and you want to ask not just about criminal background, but about charges, about citations, about misdemeanor charges. I ask the same questions to my clients about four or five different ways when I talk to them. I always tell them the same story. When I began practicing law decades ago, I was doing criminal defense, and I went and met one of my clients in jail just prior to a bail hearing. Anyone here ever done any criminal defense? Bail, one of the factors in bail is whether the person has a prior criminal record. You want to know if you're going to let them out on bail, whether they're going to be a danger to the public. And prior criminal record helps tell the court that they're a danger to the public. So I asked this guy, I said, you ever been convicted of a crime? And he says, no. And I said, okay, good. And then we started into his employment, and he'd been employed for about 2 months before being arrested. And I said, okay, where were you employed before that? And he gives me a name, and I said, from when to when were you employed by this guy? And there's an 18-month gap between his last employment and the next employment. I said, well, what were you doing for those 18 months? Just unemployed? And he says, no, I was in prison. And I said, well, how were you in prison for 18 months if you've never been convicted of a crime? He said, I was totally innocent. I said, what? He said, it was a wrongful conviction. The jury was wrong. And I said, but you were, in fact, convicted of a crime and sent to prison. He said, they didn't convict me. I just went to prison wrongly. So I was struggling to explain to this guy how he had, in fact, been convicted. But that's when I learned, always ask the question lots of different ways. If you ask your client on the phone or in your office, do you have any kind of criminal background, most of the time they're going to say no. Or they're going to say, well, nothing really serious or something like that. So you delve into it, not just because your client will try to minimize or downplay or will misunderstand whether they really do have a criminal background, but because much more goes into a shady or nefarious background than just criminal convictions. There are a lot of things that can disqualify you for a lot of jobs, and they don't always have to be felony-level federal charges. Charges of domestic violence, citations for domestic violence. Is anyone aware that you can be cited as a municipal ordinance violation for domestic violence? I just know that from my practice. I'm not confessing to anything. But you can be cited for that. And domestic violence citations and disorderly conduct citations can carry with them prohibitions that can keep people from getting into various professions, even though they're not criminal convictions. Let me give you a true life example of a lawyer who went to law school, applied to, anyone here old enough to have applied to the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility to get in? That's who I had to apply to. So I went to the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility, a lawyer went to the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility to apply, and the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility asked whether they'd ever been convicted of any crimes, and whether they had any other kinds of ordinance violations or potentially unethical activity. And this lawyer thought back to the time when he was 19 and was busted at a party. He had thrown a going away party for one of his friends, had been cited for contributing to the delinquency of minors for serving beer to a bunch of 19-year-old friends when the drinking age was 21. So this lawyer disclosed that to the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility, and this lawyer then had to go through a two-month period of getting records from the Oconomowoc Municipal Court from 1987 to try and prove to the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility that this drinking ticket, an underage drinking ticket, should not keep this lawyer out of the practice of law. And if that is the kind of thing that keeps you from getting into a legal practice or getting into any other kind of licensed or regulated profession, it's not a criminal conviction, and you want to dig far into it, because the school has to certify that you are qualified to enter into the profession that you are going into. And so if they ask about these things on the student loan application and you answer them truthfully, the school should tell the student up front, you're not qualified to become a lawyer, a paralegal, a hairdresser. Hairdressers are licensed. You're not qualified to become a private investigator. You're not qualified to become an over-the-road truck driver. People that have to be licensed, insured, bonded, or otherwise certified have a whole bunch of things in their background that can disqualify them. And if the school knows that up front, they should not have this person incur $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 worth of federally guaranteed debt that they're going to have to pay back for the rest of their life. So when you ask your client about their background, you want to go all the way back to the teen years. And you want to say, what is it that's keeping you from working in your profession? And that's really the final question you're going to ask your client is, why aren't you able to pay these loans back? Are you working in the field that you wanted to work in? Are you training in the field that you wanted to train in? Because if they're not, that tells you something's up. No one goes to school for 4 years to become a paralegal or 3 years to become a lawyer. That seems odd, doesn't it? But they don't go that long with the intention of not working in their field. And so if they're calling you up as bankruptcy lawyers and saying, I can't pay back my student loans, I'm not making the kind of money I thought I was going to get in my field, you want to delve into that. You know, well, what happened? Have you applied for jobs? Are you qualified for jobs? And those qualifications, the ability to benefit test, is wide open, because while there's specific things that can disqualify you from a student loan or disqualify you from working in your field, the ability to benefit criteria under the administrative discharge says that despite this, or along with the specific factors set out in the regulations, it's any other factor the secretary deems sufficient to determine that you don't have the ability to benefit from your student loan. And what I see as a consumer protection litigator, any other factor, what I see is a hole that's wide enough to drive a whole bunch of clients through until a judge somewhere starts telling me, no, 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 we're going to get rid of that, we're going to get rid of that, we're going to get rid of that. That in the consumer protection field, all these any other factors or any other portion the court may deem necessary or without limiting the above, those kinds of things are where lawyers make their money from their clients and help their clients. Because any lawyer can sit down and say, oh, well, you went to cosmetology school and you had a felony conviction, you were never going to get licensed. It's the good lawyers who can talk to someone and say, you went to paralegal school, you had a municipal ordinance violation, this school should have warned you that it would be extremely difficult to get employed as a paralegal with that kind of background check. And so you're going to start seeing good lawyers taking those cases that are questionable. They're admittedly questionable. It's not clear whether the secretary will deem that a factor for administrative discharge and start piling this on. They're going to say, look, this person paid $35,000 to get an education in cosmetology or over-the-road truck driving or being a chef, and they're unemployable for this reason, and the school knew that and should have told them. You're also going to look at whether the school learned it along the way, because even if the first year you apply to, say, law school or cosmetology school and you're fine, and then you get in trouble. You get like a drunk driving citation. Drunk driving will probably keep you out of the state bar these days. So if you get some kind of drunk driving citation the first year and you reapply for a loan in the second year, you're again certifying, and the school is certifying, that you're eligible to work in your field. And if they know about these things, they should probably warn you about it. So you want to really delve into the background. I spend almost every initial interview with the client, the reason Jennifer and Taylor have to pre-screen these is when I sit down to meet with the client, I'm in there for an hour or two at least. I tell them, you know, I'm going to free up about 2 hours because I'm going to really dig into it, and I'm not going to let them, you know, go unanswered. I want to know every possible angle that I can get. So once you're done talking to the client for this hour or two, let's move on to a little bit about what you might want to know about the loan or the school. Let's talk about the school first, and particularly what the student did at that school. What do you want to know about their attendance and time at the school? Thoughts, questions, ideas? Someone's got to have some thoughts. This is a room full of lawyers. I guarantee you, if there's 30 lawyers in this room, there's 45 opinions out there. So let's take a guy in the bluish purple shirt back here. You're smiling. Looks like you have an opinion. Yep, what's your name?
David.
David.
Well, I think you alluded to it before. If you don't attend and you don't participate, then that may be a cost.
That might be. What are they attending at the school? What do you want to know if they were attending?
Classes.
When you go to a school, what do you attend?
The classes that you borrow.
The classes. So you're taking classes in a specific course, right? A specific major, a specific program of instruction. You want to find out what program of instruction they pursue. One of the cases in your materials is a guy trying to claim that he would not be employed as a paralegal or security guard, and therefore he didn't have the ability to benefit, and the school falsely certified. The secretary denied his discharge and said, well, you took some paralegal courses. You were in just more of a general study sort of bachelor degree program. You weren't going to get any specific degree, so that you didn't have to benefit in any specific way. So the person comes into you and says, I was going to study paralegal stuff. You want to say, okay, were you enrolled in a paralegal course, or were you just planning on becoming a paralegal? And there's steps along the way. If you know, like, nursing school, most of the time nursing students have to start with 1 or 2 years of sort of general education classes before they begin the really specific nursing stuff. So if they're in that first or second year of general education classes and something happens to knock them out, they may not be eligible anymore to become employed as a nurse, but their course of study might not have been specifically focused enough to accept them from the ability to benefit test. So they might not qualify for the discharge. So you have to ask, what courses were you enrolled in? Were you asked to designate a major? Then you want to find out, if they withdrew again, why they might have withdrawn. One of the things that happens frequently at, especially like technical schools and these private schools, like, I probably shouldn't name any of them, but these private schools that we've all heard about as being subject to various administrative actions, is that they change professors, classes aren't available, in some way the school pulls people in and then prevents them from finishing. And that's one of the things I think that has a significant amount of leeway in this ability to benefit, is if you're going through this program and you don't get the classes that you want, but you work your way through sound mixing or computer programming, and you just lack the technical capabilities that we would all expect. If, for example, a lawyer comes out of law school and for some reason was never able to take civil procedure or legal research and writing, that's going to be a big hamper on their ability to get a job in any firm. If you say, well, they just never had, at some smaller law school, they never had a civil procedure class that was available to me. Paralegals who don't get civil procedure types of classes or drafting or legal research, you might have someone that, even though they look like they finished the program, they're not really going to be employable. And so the school, each time that they're recertifying these loans, they're saying, not only is this person a high school graduate with no known disqualifiers, but we are giving them an education that will qualify them to work in this particular field. So the more specialized the area of study, the more you want to delve into what classes they took, what classes they tried to take, what classes were made unavailable or had a course schedule that was unavailable for them. So you really want to dig into that, and you want to look at their grades and how the grading was handled, because again, if the school is in some way affecting their grades or their ability to do something that would impress employers, the school may be falsely certifying their ability to benefit. They're going through the motions of providing an education, but when these people graduate, we in the industry look at them and say, you're not really employable. You may have a paralegal degree or cosmetology degree, but you don't actually have the functional knowledge that would allow you to work in my office. And so these people didn't have the ability to benefit. So you want to really dig into the background on the school. And as these people are telling you what was going on, you know, one of the things that I always do, we all have Google, we all have access to the internet. You look up administrative actions on the school. You look up whether they've been sued in other cases. You can find all 50 states and all district courts for free on FastCase on WISPAR. So you can start looking into what other claims were made against this school. I had someone come into my office for a private university once where they were worried that the school was in fact trying to get them to quit. And so we looked up the school, and while this seemed like a far-fetched story this person was telling me, as I'm looking at other cases against this school that have been filed around the country, other cases have been filed alleging just that the school had made it difficult for students or hadn't provided some sort of classroom instruction to professors, and these other students were also alleging that the school was attempting to get them to quit. And so we managed to get in contact with the administration of this school and work things out, but you can go and find some verification for your client's claims. And you can see whether this is, in fact, a University of Wisconsin or Marquette, or if they're a private school that would probably be flying under the radar, other than appealing to people who have limited means to go to a better school. So you delve into the class load, you delve into the type of school especially. If it's a general studies school, a Madison College or a Waukesha Community Technical College, where people can get kind of a liberal arts degree, that may make it less likely that this person had the kind of focus study you need to get the ability to benefit test. If it's a specific school, culinary arts school, programming school, film schools, those kinds of things, much more likely that they're going to have in-depth materials to get the people the ability to benefit. And if that person is going to film school as opposed to just the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, and they're not working in the film industry, that's a good lead that this person in some way was not adequately prepared. So that's the kind of thing that you're going to want to, as lawyers, start expanding on the any other factor for ability to benefit test. I think one of the things that lawyers can do, and bankruptcy lawyers are primed to do it too, is to start establishing what things really do qualify the ability to benefit. And as you push these things through the Secretary of Education, they're going to start having to make those decisions, and there will be administrative decisions available for everyone else to start reviewing. Now it's going to start getting easier on those listservs to say, I've got this person that went to a culinary school, they didn't graduate, what do people think? And you're going to get 8 answers back to say, I had the same thing, and the secretary discharged her loan. So you want to dig into that and start sharing that information. I touched on, has a school been subjected to any other claims? The other thing I always look into is what kind of marketing the school has done. One reason I look into that is I always want to know why my particular client opted to go to the school. And again, that's sort of a sideline. It's probably a little bit beyond what you want to do in your practices. But again, if the school is falsely marketing itself, the lender may have some liability for that. So if the person was told, come to this school, 90% of our graduates are working within the field and making $50,000 or more per year, that's a marketing tool. The school was induced into it. If that's false, you may be able to get them out of their student loans, not through the administrative discharge, but through just the basic application of state deceptive trade practices laws. So I ask them about that, but I also look to see whether the marketing focus has changed. Because students always don't always know what's going on at the administration, but if you have a school that's really pushing its nursing studies for a couple of years, and then suddenly they've backed off and there's not a lot of nursing advertising and they're talking about sound engineering or something like that, that can be your clue that something happened in that school that they no longer feel like they're capable of getting people into the nursing program or getting them out of the nursing program and working in it. Now, everyone here familiar with accreditation? You know, when a school is accredited, have you ever had to look into that? We mostly don't deal with it because schools are mostly accredited and have to be accredited if they're going to qualify for federal student loan guarantees. Anyone want to take a guess on what happens if the school loses its accreditation while the student is there? Let's see a show of hands as to how many people think that affects your student loans. I probably led that the wrong way. Jennifer thinks it affects your student loans. Anyone think it affects your student loans? It can't. It's always a trick question with me. If they lose their accreditation while the student is going there and continue to allow the person to take out loans or solicit loans for them, that can affect the dischargeability of the loans following the loss of accreditation. But a student who attends a school, either knowing that it's not accredited or who loses it, does not retroactively get the right to discharge those loans, especially if those credits would transfer or be usable at another school. That's an exception to the closed school loan. And the accreditation is similar to the closed school loan, but the number one thing to remember is it's not retroactive. So if you're there for your freshman and sophomore years, lose accreditation, and then try and get out of those loans for your freshman and sophomore years, secretary is going to say those loans were valid, the school was valid, it was accredited at the time, we're not going to let you out of those. Now, if you can, you want to tell your client, go try and transfer those credits, because if the credits don't transfer, it might be a little easier to get an ability to benefit discharge, but the loss of accreditation alone does not make the student loans dischargeable. So finally, we're going to get into what do you want to know about the student loans themselves? Anyone? What's the first question you're going to ask?
Is it federal or private?
Is it federal or private? That's a great question.
Who
That can affect the dischargeability. What about, and this is, I like to lead with this because it has kind of a dual purpose, are you making payments on the loans? Anyone think that's important to ask? I see some heads nodding. Let's go in the middle there. What's your name?
Rebecca.
Rebecca, why do you think it's important to know if they're making payments on the loan?
It's going to show up. For the administrative, that going back to the ability, it's going to show that they did get a benefit and they are making money and they are able to pay the student loans back, so the student may have gotten the benefit.
That's exactly right. If they're able to pay on the loan, they probably got something out of their education. Now, conversely, if they're able to pay on the loan, they're going to at least look like they're acting in good faith. Someone who's not paying on the loan may look like they're trying to get out of their loan just because they don't want to pay on it. So if they're not paying on the loan, you want to ask them, well, what is your income? How much can you pay? Have you made any payments? Why are you not paying? The other reason I like to know if people are paying on the loan is because if you do get an administrative discharge, they're going to get refunded all of the money that they paid back, which is important. Bankruptcy lawyers, why? Let's go with Justin. Justin's used to dealing with some of my clients, so why is that important?
So you can get paid. Right?
Exactly. So you can get paid. I understand that bankruptcy lawyers are particularly concerned about getting paid, far more so than consumer protection lawyers who just keep doing this day after day with no hope of compensation. But if their client's going to get $5,000, $10,000 back, you've got a reason to start representing them. You've got a reason to tell them, look, I know you can pay me for this. If I think I can get you the administrative discharge, I can get paid out of that. And if they're able to make their payments as they go along, they're probably able to pay you something. So I like to ask that question up front, both to know if they have the ability to benefit and to know if there's a chance that I'm going to get paid out of this and how much I'm going to get paid, because we don't necessarily want to work for free. But a person that's paid $10,000 on their student loans and who has a likelihood of getting this back, there's no reason you can't take a swing at representing them and try and take, you know, a standard contingent fee out of that, perhaps, if that's what you want to do. So you want to know if they're paying on the loan and how much they've paid. You also probably want to know who they're paying, because if they're not paying the servicer, the loan is probably in default. They may be paying collection charges. Attorney's fees are allowable on these things. So all of that can be refundable, but you want to know why they went into default and why they're paying, say, collection charges or who they've been contacted by. There are, again, other consumer protection reasons for knowing whether it's a collection agent or an attorney trying to collect on them versus just a loan servicer or the Department of Education. Those can lead to different legal remedies, so if you ever run into those, feel free to drop me an email. We can talk about what to do at that point. You want to know whether the client has their paperwork. Why would that be important? Anyway. I don't want to have to pick on someone again. How about in the glasses back here? Can I pick on you?
I just want to know what the terms are.
You want to know what the terms might be. What else do you want to know from the paperwork? Anything? Yes?
Who the original guarantor was.
Who the original guarantor was. That might be important because that might be who you have to apply initially for as a servicer. What I'm getting at is you want to know what information the school and the lender actually asked for from the student. And if they don't have their paperwork, it's almost certainly with the servicer and with the school. Because when the student is telling you, I had a prior conviction, or I was not a high school graduate, or whatever they're saying is their reason for the administrative discharge, you want to know if the school and the lender had any reason to know about that. Remember, the lender is getting certified information to the Department of Education. So the lender is saying, this information is verifiable and this is why the person is qualified for this government guaranteed student loan. And if they don't ask about it, they may not know. There are certain things that they're required to ask about. There are certain things that they ask about even though they're not required to do it. There are certain things that may get volunteered by the student. So you want to look, if at all possible, at the original paperwork. It's also important to look at the original paperwork to see if the student actually signed it and the dates that they signed it. You want to make sure that this all matches up, especially if you're dealing with one of these smaller schools, the fly-by-night schools, the trucking schools kinds of things, because it's not a guarantee that the school didn't in some way forge the paperwork or alter the paperwork, so the student is not in fact getting the deal that they thought they were getting. So you always want to ask for the original paperwork. Most people don't have that, but they have at least something that you can then go and start digging into this. What else might you want to know about the actual loan before you decide if you can get your student an administrative discharge. We touched on who the original lender was. Everyone know how the student loans are handled? Do you know the path a student loan takes? Raise your hand if you know the path a student loan takes. I won't call on you. Just raise your hand. And yet we've all taken them out. I saw that show of hands at the beginning. I know the path a student loan takes because we've litigated this. So you go to the school, you fill out the application, usually the free application for federal student aid. The school then tells you what aid you're qualified for. You check off the boxes for the aid you want, and that's all we know, right? You get your check a couple of weeks later, they pay your tuition, you take the extra money, and you use it always for educational purposes. But from there, the school typically finds a private lender. There's two ways that this can go. It can come directly from the federal government, or it can come from a private lender. And that private lender or the federal government almost always have a guarantee agency that's essentially sort of a reinsurer in there. That guarantee agency guarantees the lender or the school or whoever's making the loan that they will be paid back. That guarantee agency is then itself guaranteed by the Department of Education. Only Congress could have come up with this structure. But that's the way it goes. Then, to throw another one into the mix, the student loans typically have a servicer, which is usually not the original lender or the Department of Education or the guarantee agency. It's someone like Sallie Mae, Navient, Great Lakes Higher Education, these servicers. So the servicers are the ones that are actually dealing with the loans. And you want to know who the servicer is, and you want to know if the servicer has changed. You want to know that for two reasons. First of all, your application goes to the servicer. That's who you're getting your information to and who you're getting your information from. Also, if the servicer has changed, you want to know if any previous applications or information was given to this other servicer, such as did they actually hear this before and deny an administrative discharge, in which case your remedies will change. Now, there's nothing in the law that says you cannot reapply for an administrative discharge, especially if the servicer has changed, and some of these cases have people reapplying 4, 5, 6 times. So you can keep throwing stuff at the Secretary of Education. They talk about the Secretary of Education making the decision. It's the servicer and then ratified by the Secretary. You can keep doing that, but after a point, it becomes somewhat futile. If they've denied it 3 or 4 times before, you're probably not going to get very far with a further application for that. Anything else you might want to know about the loan that's important to know if there's an administrative discharge question being asked about you? I know this is a question that bankruptcy attorneys are used to asking, so I'm just going to throw it out there one more time. What else might you want to ask? The one thing we haven't covered yet.
The amount of the loan?
In what capacity?
If it's unreasonably high compared to the education they were getting.
I'll give you credit for that. Did we give Justin a bar yet?
I got one.
All right, he's got his bar. I'll give you that. You want to know how much is owed on the loan. And you want to know that both because if it's unreasonably high or if the interest is racking up or penalties are racking up, that's going to tell you if there's been a problem on the loan. And you want to know, frankly, if it's worth it to go through any trouble of an administrative discharge. If you have someone that owes $2,000 or $3,000 left on their loan, or $4,000 or $5,000 even, it's very hard to imagine getting a lawyer's help for less than a couple of $1,000s. If any of you will help someone for less than a couple of $1,000s, let me know. I have lots and lots of cases to refer over to you. But I tell people, you know, if you're going to go through the administrative discharge process, you're going to fight your student loans, it's going to cost you at least a couple of $1,000s to help prepare this application to go through it. Now, clients can prepare it themselves and you can review it. That's a little cheaper. I don't like to do that. But you want to know how much is owed because you want to tell them, look, I can do this for you, but even if I win, it's going to cost you $3,000 or $4,000. You've only got $5,000 left to pay. There may be other things that you can do. So you want to know how much is owed overall and how much remains to be paid, because that will again tell you whether it's worth it and if there's anything sort of underhanded or fishy going on with the loan. So having covered all that, let's talk then about the case I didn't mention in your materials. How much time do we have left?
3 minutes.
All right, that'll be just enough time to tell you how to definitely win when you have to go to court and ask a federal judge to overrule the Secretary of Education. I'm going to give you one clue. It's one word. There's one magic legal word that you want to know that you're definitely going to win when you file that Administrative Procedures Act review case. Can anyone guess what that one word is? Let's see. Let's have Jennifer pick someone up. You've been watching, who's paying attention. Pick someone up. We've only got 3 minutes left.
You're going to put me on the spot. No.
Do you know the word?
No.
It's my favorite word in the law, too.
Unconscionable?
Close. That's my second favorite. My favorite word is default. So case of Levante Washington versus Arne Duncan, right here in our own United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Levante Washington applies for an administrative discharge and asserts that he's entitled to an ability to benefit discharge because he had a pre-existing felony conviction that kept him from working in his field of choice, paralegals or security guard. And he's denied the administrative discharge by the secretary. So he files an Administrative Procedure Act claim, and he serves it on the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice does not answer. They move to extend the time, saying that they have to get some time to find the file. Then they don't answer again. They move to extend the time again, saying they have to find the time to file, or they have to find the file in order to file an answer. Then they finally come in with what every federal litigant does these days, you probably see enough of this yourself, a 12B6 motion. They said he failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted because all he's done in his petition, and it took about 90 to 120 days for the Department of Justice to work through this, all he's done is he's filed a petition that lists the facts of his case, saying he applied for a loan, he had a felony conviction, they asked him about it, he told them about it, and then they still certified his ability to benefit from this course of instruction. And the only backing he's got, which is just ridiculous from a pro se litigant, is he's got a copy of the judgment of conviction, and he's got proof that he exhausted his administrative remedies, and he's got a decision from the Department of Education saying we're denying you an administrative discharge. So we can all see where he's clearly failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, right? If all he's got is a bunch of facts and documents to support his claim. So Judge Randa, I think it is, looked at this one and said what Judge Randa would say about that. No, he's stated a claim. All you have to do to state a claim is provide facts that make it a plausible argument. So he stated a claim. Judge Randa denied the motion to dismiss, and the Department of Justice, with the crack litigation skills we know the Department of Justice has already demonstrated in this case, has still, as of when I printed this case, not answered that complaint, leading, what's the guy's name again? Levante Washington, pro se litigant, to move for a default judgment that was still pending at the time that I reviewed this. So how many people here think Judge Randa ought to grant that default judgment motion? How many people here think he will? All right, that's what I'll wrap up with. Any questions? All right, then I've done my job. Thanks very much. You've been a really good crowd.
Where was your class?
Thanks very much to Brian. And again, sorry I came in a little bit late and I'm suffering with a little bit of a cold. So I hope I didn't interfere too much with your ability to take away this important information. We do have a couple of things planned for later in the year, but nothing coming up. So please think about volunteering or suggesting a topic, and we will do our best to keep the Lou Jones breakfast going. Thanks again, everybody, for coming. Thank you. I want to shake your hand because of my cranky cold, but thank you.